I think it's a distinctly Western view, better living through chemicals. Because we, interestingly, when we started growing with all of our clients who come from other countries, you know, one of the things that I said right out of the gate was we're going to grow without chemicals. We don't have the luxury of saying, you know, even getting certified organic, but we can say we're earth friendly, and I don't want these folks who are already having enough challenge getting fresh foods to also now have, okay, well, now you've got your fresh food, you might want to rinse it off before you eat it, because, well, nobody in our program was at all interested in chemicals. Nobody said, this is how I grow it, you know, and a lot of them were living in refugee camps, and it's not inherent in people to chemicalize their foods. That is just, you know, a habitual thing that's happened over time, and it is strongly related to, you know, the environmental degradation that we have going on right now. We are depleting the soils, we are polluting the waters, and you know, that's chemical based.
The sad thing is, you know, I used to think that organic food was kind of like a designer handbag. Good for you if you can afford it, but, you know, I don't want to pay extra for the organic sticker because nobody's going to see that. Since I've become more educated about it, I understand it's so important to not only consume the organic food, but to support the people that are growing organic food. And here's the sad conflict that we have in this country. In order to grow organic food, you have to spend a lot of money to become certified. So in order to do it right, in order to do it well, in order to do it sustainably and environmentally friendly, you have to pay extra money and work harder, because that's why it's harder to grow organic food. That's why the larger farms don't do it. Then our government charges organic farmers to become certified while giving discounts to the farms that are polluting our streams and basically creating all this environmental damage. They're going to buy their stuff and, you know, put all the money in that pocket while charging the people doing it right. So it's just wrong.
And not just the people doing it right, but the way it's been done for thousands of years.
The way it needs to be done, or we're not going to have much of a planet. You know, our meat consumption alone is taking up 50% of the land mass on the planet to grow the crops to feed the livestock. And we're slashing our rainforests, and we're, you know, the livestock manure and methane gas produced, that's a larger problem than cars. Literally, cows pollute the environment more than cars do. So it's great to drive a Prius, but if you're stopping for the steak on the way home, it kind of cancels out, you know, the environmental good. And people need to understand the true cost of their food. And when you're eating food that's subsidized by the government and creating money for corporations, it's falsely cheap. It's just, meat is not cheap. And, you know, the rainforests are the lungs of the planet. Can't live very long if you cut your lungs out, and that's kind of what we're doing. So
it's a great metaphor.
Now let me interject. I have a Prius, mm-hmm. and every once in a while I get a craving for red meat. So I don't want to feel like, and I wouldn't want anybody to feel like those baby steps they're taking, or in some cases very radical steps, are canceled out because of some other thing they do. I think yes, ideally we would all be, you know, maybe ideally we would all be vegans. I don't know. There are a lot of people for whom meat is critically important.
And culturally important.
Right, right. Well, important in very many ways. But I think, you know, there's another side to that tipping point, which is if we want people to change, we cannot give them the Encyclopedia Britannica of information. What we give to them is an option at our table. Mm-hmm. When you come to my table, here's your option. You can have this food or you can have that food. You know, I think it's the adage, you know, you get more flies with honey.
Yes.
Organic honey.
And how either one of you can address this, when someone says, you know, it's better to have food than to not have it, when the food choices are, as we've discussed, that are so omnipresent in our society, are not healthy. How do you address that? It's better to have some food than not to have any.
I think
forget this whole organic thing.
I think that's completely utilitarian. I mean, that's the mindset of the greatest good for the greatest number, assuming that it is the greatest good. I was saying to Colleen this morning, I stopped in a drugstore and was asked if I wanted to donate a candy bar to the food bank. And, you know, okay, let's set aside the fact that, no, I don't want to give people candy. What if, you know, my child is receiving something from the food bank and she doesn't like that particular item or can't eat that particular item? She deserves the same option of having a treat as those who can't afford it. So I don't think this notion of, listen, if you're hungry enough, you're going to eat it, is anything less than absurd. When we go to other countries, when the United States makes these mission trips to other countries to help stave off starvation, we don't show up with, you know, popcorn and taco-flavored chips. We show up with protein-packed meals. Now, you know, okay, there's a whole other discussion about what's in those meals, but we try to get to people, reasonable minds try to get people nutritious food that can sustain them, and then once they are not in a life-threatening situation, provide them the food that is appropriate for them. And I'm really, I really, that rubs me the wrong way when people say, hey, if you're hungry enough, you're going to eat this. I just think that's completely short-sighted.
And I think to address your question, change takes place over time. So I don't think we should outlaw candy bars and food banks. I don't think that that's going to help. What I do think is that over time, as we all demand better food, the leftovers that go to the food bank are inherently going to get better. So I think setting our sights long-term, it's very similar to you know, the coal and gasoline issue. I understand, you know, I lived in West Virginia and I see what mountaintop removal is doing, and it's horrific. I also understand that our current technology, we still need coal for electricity. I get it, and I respect the men and women that do it. What I'd like is somebody up in the tower saying, okay, let's use today's coal to produce tomorrow's sustainable energy. So let's stock our food banks with food that we have for now, but let's set goals to provide, as they are doing at Community Harvest Food Bank, provide more fresh produce, provide more, and then eventually, over time, we use what we have to create what we need, and we move forward. It just takes awareness and intention, I think.
Right. It's a universal budget. It's determining what you can afford when you are long-term planning for your future. And we can't afford to consume like we're consuming, to eat like we're eating, to spend like we're spending on the foods that we currently do in these United States.
And I would add waste, all the
exactly.
food waste, whether in our school cafeterias
right.
or from our grocery stores or from restaurants, all the food that ends up in a dumpster. There's so many issues here to food equity. I didn't mean to interrupt you, though. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine.
It's interesting in Europe. There are statistics. In the United States, we spend 20% approximately of our income on health care per person. Of course, not everybody has health care, but this is a national statistic. 20% of our income goes to health care. Less than 10% buys our food. In Europe, the average cost of health care is less than 10%, but they spend about 20% on their food. So people eventually, as we begin to understand that food creates health, we're willing to spend more money on our food. And I see people, you know, I've seen documentaries where there's that immigrant family living in the inner city and they have diabetes and they have to choose between picking up their pills and taking $4 and going and eating at McDonald's because that's all they can afford. I get it. What would you do? Do you stop taking the pills today? You still have diabetes. But eventually, hopefully, those people will have choices. It's like we have a choice. Do we spend the money on pills to fix the problem that we're creating when we eat, or do we spend the money to create the health when we eat the food? So
we're in a society that kind of lives for today and doesn't really think about, you know, some of the consequences of that. And when my husband and I had our daughter, you know, that was probably the biggest wake-up call. You go through your 20s, you're completely invincible, you know, whatever. You've got plenty of years to change your habits. Then you have a kid, and all of a sudden, you know, game over. You have to be responsible to that. We are fortunate. We're lucky to have that luxury of saying, you know, do we want to pack her lunch? Do we want to, you know, if you're not, you know, if you're in poverty and you're eating the food that the school gives you free, you don't have those choices. I was telling Colleen, our school's kicked off this breakfast program this past year, and they sent home a flyer, and it was all fancy and snazzy, and said, now your child can have nutritious, warm breakfast at school, and the menu was enclosed, and there were Pop-Tarts on there, and there were those Cinnabons on there, and it just, for me, it was just, you know, it left me speechless. Needless to say, my daughter is not signed up for that program. But if you are a family in need and the only food you can get, whether or not you're an immigrant or a refugee or an American, if you are held hostage by somebody else's doctrine about what you can eat, it's inequitable. It's not fair. It's not right. And it's going to come back around, you know, one way or the other.
And what about those refugee or asylee populations you work with, when their children enter our schools living on very limited incomes and their children are on these free food programs? What do those children do?
Well, a lot of them, from what I've seen, acclimate very easily to these fast food, sugared up. I mean, you know, come on. Chemicals, they are habit forming. Sugar is very habit forming. Caffeine is habit forming. These things are habit forming.
They're good.
Right, right. And they give you a false sense of fullness. You know, you eat a Pop-Tart, you feel pretty good there for about an hour, you know, never mind that you're hungry. Yeah, and then you fall asleep in class. But yeah, the kids that, listen, when the refugees come over here, for the most part, the parents do not speak anything other than their home language, and the kids are young enough that they learn English. They're picking it up pretty well. So that internal communication gap leaves a lot of room for decision making at the child's level rather than the parent's level. So this child is in school with cohorts, and they're all eating Pop-Tarts, and this child maybe once or twice tried to come to school with naan or some other thing that they're used to eating. Not if you're going to get made fun of, and not if this starts to taste good to you. It's just, you know, there are a lot of obstacles in the way of eating fresh. And I think it just takes a lot of voices, a lot of discussion.
And it's cultural, and we can change it. You know, my daughter told me that one day she got the hot dog at school. She didn't eat it, but she was tired of her friends making fun of her. Now, the thing is kids are kids. I get it. She has a friend who is Indian, who's also a vegetarian, so she tends to eat her lunch more with her. But I understand that, and as a society, we're creating that. We're making it seem like saying no to a hot dog is something to be laughed at. And I still feel peer pressure, you know, to eat or to allow my children, you know, well, it's a special day. Well, you know, every day is a special day in our schools. It's Cupcake Wednesdays and it's Donut Fridays. And then you go to the concession stand and you get the nacho cheese. And then, you know, you go to the ballpark and it's cotton candy. Every single day, I feel like I have to fight a war to try to just not let my kids eat everything that's being bombarded at them. And that's what has to change.
And that, in a previous podcast with Dr. Richard Wilk, that's what he called nutritainment.
Mm-hmm.
Our food it entertains us. It's sweet, it's salty, it's
got
looks
a prize
good,
at the
it
bottom.
Tastes great. Yeah, it's all about, the, like you said, every day is a celebration.
Yeah, every single day is special.
Now, for listeners who've never thought about food equity issues, and we've covered many today, what were some concluding thoughts you'd like to leave with them?
I would say baby steps and buying power. You know, I, you know, don't think it's realistic to think we could, by any stretch, convince an entire community or even an entire school system to stop and reevaluate completely what they're doing. But I do applaud when I show up at school and the first two options are fresh fruit and fresh vegetables. And I think, most importantly, if you can't figure out any other way, You have got to try new things. Come to the farmers markets and buy the taro or one of the other ethnic fruits or vegetables that are there. Become aware of it. Start to, you know, request interesting things at the grocery store. If we all stop buying iceberg lettuce, they stop having so much iceberg lettuce, and they have a lot more mixed greens and a lot more ethnic choices there. So I would say definitely use your buying power.
As parents, we often tell our, I mean, I know I've said it a million times, well, you can learn to like that. But what I find really interesting as a parent with lots of friends, how many of my friends refuse to acknowledge that they too could learn to like something. So I think purchasing power is very important. And not, okay, what I would say is don't be afraid to stand up for your beliefs because, for example, when I first became vegan, sometimes I didn't say I was vegan. I said, well, you know, I eat mostly a plant-based diet because you can fly that word under the radar and nobody really catches on that you're a weird vegan. But now I've decided, you know, my blog is Waking Up Vegan. I use the word vegan at least 3 times an hour as much as possible because I figure if I'm kind of normal. Well, let's see. I appear to be normal. I don't wear hippie clothing. I don't live in a tree. So if I can use the word vegan, then maybe somebody else that's even more fearful of how that might feel for them will use the word plant-based diet, you know? And so the more of us that move together, we create a new normal. So if you have convictions about the way you want to feed your kids, make friends with other people like that because there's strength in numbers. And so that's all I can say is if we could get a few more people who ask for vegetables and ask for healthy foods at large events, then I won't be the only one there doing that.
Listen, I am a tree-hugging hippie. I just, you don't see that when I'm at work. But I think that there can be a quiet movement that makes just as much noise as a noisy movement. And I think it's great if you want to shout from the rooftop that you're vegan or that you stand for anything, stand for something. I like that. But I also have a daughter who's a wallflower, and if she goes through her life quietly standing by her beliefs, I am going to be just as proud of her as if she were, like me, shouting from the rooftops. So I think, you know, anything that you can do, whether it's have your friend Colleen over for dinner and try a new vegan recipe, or, you know, buy something new at the store, or make an adventure of it with your kids, anything you can do is going to not only influence your circle, but eventually there will be that impact that we're talking about, that the more voices, the more action toward fresh, local food, the better off we're going
to
be.
And if the only change you make is to be nicer to the vegan sitting next to you, that's a good change, too. That's a good start.
Or to any person who eats differently. Right. It doesn't matter whether it's vegan or they only eat meat and nothing else.
You know? I sit next to people like that all the time, and it doesn't bother me. That's their choice. They have a right to choose how they eat. And so do I. And I think that's what we're talking about with food equity. We all have a right to say what we will and what we won't eat. And if the only change you make is recognizing that everyone has that inherent right, we're already moving in the right direction.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.